You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
6 minutes after 12, I'm Mandy Wiener in for Stephen Curtis on the Midday Report today. Remember, you can always tweet me at Mandy Wiener, and you can send me an SMS at 31702 or 31567. Over the next hour, we'll get Ranjini Munsami's take on the German elections. She's actually in Berlin this week, keeping an eye on those. We'll speak to a debt consultant about whether you should be financing your grocery shopping on credit. And we'll also keep you up to speed on the ANC's court bid to have a vote of no confidence in Mayor Herman Mashaba. That's happening at the High Court in Joburg today. But first, meeting today, Finance Minister Malusi Gigaba and the Public Investment Corporation. They're holding a crucial meeting to deal with reports that the government plans on raiding the PIC to bail out SAA and other struggling companies as well. It's been suggested that Treasury has set its sights on the PIC's coffers and it wants at least 100 billion rand to bail out struggling state-owned entities. And on Twitter, I've asked the question today, and please reply to me. You can tweet me. I've asked whether or not you think the PIC should be looted to bail out these state-owned entities or not. Malusi Gigaba has called these reports untrue, malicious, unconstructive. He insists that no approach has been made to the PIC. So a briefing is expected at 2 p.m. today. EWN reporter Barry Bateman will be there for us. Barry's joining us on the line now to preview that. Barry, what do we expect from Minister Malusi Gigaba today?
Yeah, good afternoon, Mandy. Perhaps it'll be an echo of the statement which he issued yesterday, strongly worded, saying that there has been no formal or informal request to have access to any of the PIC's funds. As you've indicated there, reports saying that about billion rand is required to bail out several state-owned entities. The PIC, of course, manages trillions of rands, and these of government employee pensions. So these are key funds that they're responsible for, but we understand that the ministry has about a month at a time to raise funds to be able to bring stability to these state-owned entities. It does appear to be a desperation if they're turning to the PIC to get their hands on that particular money. Also, reports coming out that the PIC chief executive, Dan Machila, that there's a plan to have him removed because he served as the gatekeeper and put a stop to requests and attempts to get access to those funds. So the meeting today from the ministers to say to establish where these allegations are coming from and then come to some agreement with the PIC and in particular Dan Machila. And if the statement is anything to go by, he'll tell us that there is no attempt by the government to get their hands on those funds.
That's Barry Bateman, Eyewitness News reporter. He's going to be watching that briefing by Finance Minister Malusi Gigaba. That's supposed to happen at about 2 o'clock, and we'll have an indication there about what's happening with these reports about the PIC and potential looting is the word being used, money being taken from the PIC to actually pay over two state-owned entities. Also in our studios today, former Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan. He was talking to Eusebius Mkhize about state capture, the KPMG, and this whole PIC issue. After his interview, we grabbed him outside for a few minutes and we asked him about his views on this development between the PIC and his successor, Minister Gigaba.
Finding quick and short-term answers by taking money from one entity and putting it into state-owned entities where the boards haven't changed, the management hasn't changed, the fraud hasn't been fully exposed, and the mistakes of the past haven't been corrected. For example, is Transnet still buying these locomotives where those massive commissions are being paid to a Gupta-linked entity? We don't know. Mm-hmm. It's been exposed that that's been happening, but are those purchases still going on? Nobody's asking the question. These cranes that are now exposed, what is the next thing that is going to be? So how do you keep putting money into entities that haven't been cleaned up? So the first mission is to start cleaning up, and they will become credible entities in their own right, and they'll be able to go to the market and borrow. And in fact, they'll be able to borrow at a lower cost on the one hand, but also the cost of their operations will be reduced, because hidden in the cost of their operations, therefore, in the cost of the electricity that we actually purchase from Eskom or from a municipality, all of these, the cost of all of these schemes and the billions of rands that are being stolen at the moment. So there's a far more intensive look that needs to actually happen. And I think that there are other creative answers that can be found. But at the end of the day, if we do not tackle the core problem, which is the governance, management and operations and financial stability, and the manner in which purchasing happens within these sorts of entities, we actually not solving the problem.
Former Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan speaking there about the PIC. He also spoke to Eusebius about how KPMG leadership in South Africa must understand the role they played in state capture.
We want to know the facts. So it's now very much in the public domain that if you take the SARS issues, the terms of reference were changed two or three times. Individuals were being, in fact, targeted. We all now know about the cutting and pasting from a legal memo onto the KPMG report. And like that, what else is there that, in fact, any firm with any integrity would not have done in those circumstances? And the second is to point out to them that this is not just an isolated technical matter, that you've got to see this particular set of misdemeanors on their part, both in terms of the companies that they audited, but also the institution like SARS as well, in terms of their involvement there, must be seen in the context of the state capture phenomenon in South Africa. And that, in fact, they were willing partners, so to speak. Maybe they didn't realize the magnitude of what they were doing, but for a fee, they were willing partners in a state capture project, as were many others.
When you put that perspective to them, were they partial to that view, or did they resist it? I mean, it seems trite to me as a South African, as a citizen, but I'd love to know how they responded to that.
No, I think that we opened certain windows for them on the international side to look at themselves far more carefully. And hopefully even the South African leadership that is now in place understands that the technical work can be separated from the context in instances like the ones that we are talking about. There will be instances where the technical is satisfactory, but in these situations, what we must be very clear about is that the state capture agenda is alive, it's well, it's persistent, it's resilient, and it's moving every single day.
That's former Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan speaking to Eusebius Mkhize earlier today. Listening to that is political analyst Ralf Mateka, who joins us on the line now. Ralf, what do you make of Pravin Gordhan's voice in this matter and on state capture? Is it a relevant one, as many would believe, or will his successor be the captain of his own ship, if you like?
Good afternoon, Mindy. I think that Pravin Gordhan struck a note there, and I think that we are getting used to these revelations from the emails about transactions that have happened, transactions that are suspected to be part of the state capture. As we are getting more and more used to this, we are forgetting that there is a project that is actually underway, which is state capture, which takes away the capacity of the state, and it is a vehicle through which people are pushing against development that could benefit South Africans. So it is underway, and what I think I'm observing here is that we got used to it so quickly that I fear that we are almost shifting to deal with this phenomenon as one of those things we want to write off without actually people taking responsibility. Look at the actions that are being taken outside South Africa towards KPMG, towards Delport in Djibouti. You don't see any action being taken against those alleged perpetrators within South Africa. So I think Pravin Gordhan is right there. But I also think that the ANC must acknowledge that it has been complicit to this process, because in order to capture the state, you have to start with the party. That is why the ANC cannot offer a recourse or any solid response to how to deal with this matter. It is at the center of the problem. It is part of the problem.
And Ralf, how do you see the standoff between Minister Melusi Gigaba and the PIC unfolding this afternoon and going forward? I mean, many people saying that it's not really about the money that they need. It's about certain members of the elite getting their hands into the till here.
The reality is that we do have a very strong suspicion that we are not willing to test properly within our institution. The suspicion says that you do have a group of people who are trying to get control of those development finance institutes, such as your PIC, which controls a lot of public pensions. And the aim is to actually proliferate corruption. So whatever conduct that is going to happen, whatever bailout that is being asked in relation to state-owned entities, whether or not it is for genuine intention, we will always look at it with this suspicion that it could be part of the state capture, because we are living with this reality. So until we clarify that, we are going to view any conduct of the policymakers with suspicion that it could not be in the public interest. This suspicion of state capture, it is the one that actually throws the whole policymaking machinery into a credibility crisis. It takes away the trust. Citizens will no longer be willing to trust what is actually happening there. And at PIC as well, we are also at that scenario where we know that it seems as if this is the telltale, all the interactions they have, the telltale signs of the transaction of stage capture that we have seen being revealed. And in the absence of any tangible or any meaningful deep investigation into state capture, that is unfortunately the suspicion that we are going to be looking at any conduct of politicians with.
Ralph, just briefly, Pravin Gordhan was asked by Eusebius where he sees the hope coming from. His response was, I see it from a Cyril Ramaphosa campaign. What's your take on that?
I don't think I see it within the ANC, and it should be understandable that Pravin Gordhan is a politician at the end of the day. He will not be willing to concede that the solution does not lie within the ANC. My view is that I don't think the solution within this lies within the ANC. I believe that even if Mr. Ramaphosa survives and becomes the leader of the ANC, corruption, it is so entrenched that the best we can hope for him is to manage corruption, not to eliminate it. It's nearly impossible. You need civil society to continue doing what they're doing. You need the media to continue reporting on this, because the ANC on its own cannot be relied upon to expedite this.
Political analyst Ralph Mateka giving us his views there on Pravin Gordhan's comments earlier, and also the standoff between the PIC and Melusi Gigaba. On Twitter, I asked whether or not you think funds from the PIC should be paid over to the SAA and to other state entities as well. Sean Peffer says, hell no. Where does it end? Shall we just pay our taxes and pension savings directly to the thieves? Gavin Maybe says, a question better put to the pension fund members. After all, it's their money. And Coaching Powerhouse says, of course not. Borrowing from Peter to pay Paul is never a sustainable economic strategy. Your views on this issue between the PIC and Minister Melusi Gigaba.
The Midday Report on 702.
Your number one news and talk station.
20 minutes past 12, I'm Maddie Wiener in for Stephen Curtis on the Midday Report today. And in response to state capture and corruption, hundreds of thousands of COSATU and SACP members are expected to go on strike tomorrow. Gauteng likely to take a huge knock. Organisers say the planned national shutdown is against the scourge of corruption and the capture of key state institutions by rogue elements in close proximity to the ruling elite. Alex Mashilo is the SACP spokesperson. He joins us on the line now. Alex, thanks for your time. I know that you just had a press conference in Johannesburg. So firstly, what can we actually expect to happen tomorrow? How big is it going to be, and how are Gautengers going to be affected by this?
There will be marches in all nine provinces. In Gauteng, in KwaZulu-Natal, Limpopo, Northwest Mpumalanga, Northern Cape, Free State, and in some provinces like the Eastern Cape, there will be more than one march for logistical purposes. That's the extent to which the economy will be affected tomorrow.
And which industries across the board, if people are wanting to know if their staff are going to be coming to work or not, what kind of indication can you give them?
Both public and private sector, as well as the unemployed, are welcome at the march. And that will be very important, because this march is a march to save our democratic national sovereignty from capture of our key state institutions by parasite and corporations.
Okay, so what exactly is it then that you're protesting or that you're going to be marching against? You say it's state capture. Can you give us a little bit more detail on what exactly it is that you're going to be protesting?
There are two things. Corporate state capture and corruption. And of course, because of corporate state capture and corruption, in the economy is affected.
Alex, I'm going to ask you just to move around a little bit. We're losing you a bit on the line there. If you can just walk around and see if you can improve your line there. You were saying corporate state capture and state as well.
Because of the problems of corruption and corporate state capture, partly they are very low levels of investment in the productive part of our economy. More and more workers are unemployed and others are losing their jobs. This is a problem. So the march is against corporate state capture, corruption, and job losses. And of course, there are many actions that have been taken in state-owned enterprises, in government, and in state entities that disadvantage.
Alex Mashilo, I'm going to leave it there. Unfortunately, his line just not coming to the party, the SACP spokesperson, Alex Mashilo, they're speaking about the stay away that's going to be happening. It's across the country tomorrow. We know that it's a protest by shutdown, a mass shutdown, they're calling it, by COSATU and the SACP. SAFTA and NUMSA not taking part. And of course, business is also come in, and they, Business Unity South Africa and Business Leadership South Africa, are actually supporting this march, an unusual step that business is coming in with the trade union associations to protest and to bring a shutdown against state capture. So we'll try and bring you more detail on that in the Eyewitness News Bulletin throughout the day, so you can get an indication of where these protests are going to be taking place and how you are going to be affected.
SMS us on 31702 or 31567.
24 minutes past 12, I'm Mandy Wiener in for Stephen Curtis. And this morning, police have been on standby at the Klipspruit West Secondary School after fresh reports of intimidation and tension. And you would have perhaps heard Gauteng Education MEC Panyaza Lusufi speaking on the radio this morning about this issue. He met with parents yesterday. He gave instructions for teaching and learning to resume at that Soweto school today. The school's been plagued by a series of disruptions this year, including the rejection of a black principal by the local coloured community. Steve Mabona is the spokesperson for the MEC of the Gauteng Department of Education, Panyaza Lusufi. He joins us on the line now. Steve, thanks for your time. We know that the MEC had said that teaching must take place at the school today. Can you tell us what's the state of play? Did teaching actually happen?
Thanks, Mandy. You had a big fish now. The MEC himself is not Steve.
Apologies, MEC. Thank you, MEC Panyaza Lusufi. Thanks for hijacking the phone from your spokesperson. So you're there, I imagine, at Klipspruit today. You've been on standby all day. You were tweeting about it and speaking about it earlier. What's the state of play?
Well, the situation is undesirable. There is schooling that is taking place. Learners are writing their third term examinations, but we've got 14 staff members that are not there. That is 12 teachers and two ground staff that have not reported for duty. I'm about to walk into a meeting with them now to understand why they're not at work, because yesterday we met with community leaders who gave us an assurance that they'll allow all the teachers to come back. So I'm just stepping in a meeting with them now to understand why they're not at work.
MEC, if you're not happy with the reasons that they give, if it doesn't meet your satisfaction, will you take action against them?
Well, on Thursday, I've convened a parents' meeting. I'm weighing some options because either have a school or you don't have a school. You can't have something in between. So I've convened an urgent meeting of all parents of Klipspruit, where I'll table my proposal. And at that time, that's where I would be in a position to announce what kind of action we need to take. Okay.
And you're not willing to say at this stage what your proposal is?
I don't want to, because I don't want to negotiate in good faith with both the educators as well as the parents.
Okay. And what kind of cooperation are you getting from the parents? You met with them yesterday. Are the parents cooperating? What is your feeling there?
To be quite frank, they've met their part of the agreement. The part of the agreement is that there must not be a person that is not recognized around the school gates, and they must allow the four educators that were barred from coming in to come back, and they've agreed and they've kept that part of the agreement.
MEC, you've been on the ground there, you've been at the school. Have you been able to speak to the learners? What's the feeling amongst them?
Unfortunately not. And I know their frustration, definitely, because they have to face the end of year exams, so they will be really, really be worried. But I'll meet with them before I meet with their parents also.
Okay, because ultimately it does come down to them and their exams and their futures as well, which I imagine is your major concern here.
It is. We can't compromise the quality of examination and the quality of education. I'm quite excited that matriculants are continuing to write their trial exams. They are busy with those exams. Those exams have not been disrupted. Obviously, the worry is tomorrow's national strike, which might harm or hamper some of our arrangements. But so far, I think they're running off examinations to non-track.
Okay, MEC, so just to confirm, you're going into a meeting now with parents, and then you'll make some kind of announcement on the way forward?
I'm meeting with teachers that have stayed away from work now, and at 2 o'clock I'll meet with the teachers that are at work, and at 5 o'clock I'll meet with the provincial leadership of SATU. So it's quite a long day, Mandy.
Good luck, MEC Panyaza Lesufi. I hope that finds a solution to this ongoing problem that we know has been such an issue at the Klipspruit West Secondary School. MEC Panyaza Lesufi, thank you so much for your time on the Midday Report today.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
So speaking about money, debt counsellors are warning consumers against buying food on credit, saying it will have a negative impact on overall debt. And that's because Pick and Pay has announced it's offering customers the option of purchasing groceries on credit. And you know, if you've got to buy food and finance food on credit, that you're in some kind of trouble. And this comes as StatsSA figures have been released on consumer spending. And South Africans spend more on beer than on vegetables. Beer accounts for 2.1% of total household spending, which is pretty incredible. I don't know about my household, but I think in a lot of households, that would probably be true. Statistician General Dr. Paddy Lehotla is on the line with us now. Dr. Lehotla, interesting statistics that you've released about consumer spending in South Africa. South Africans spend more money on beer than on vegetables, is that right?
Yes, indeed. I mean, this is the value of these numbers. They may sound interesting in terms of discussions around the table, but they are real. But we spend a lot more on beer than we spend on vegetables and other necessities of life. I'm not suggesting that beer is not a necessity of life, because people work there and earn money out of that and take children to school. Which in the end they entertain themselves through beer. But this is the importance of showing South Africa incorporated to understand what these numbers actually mean. And of course, they inform people who prospectively want to go into business as well.
And what do the numbers say? What are South African households spending their money on?
South African households, depending on where they sit on the income levels, spend money on a variety of things. The poor spend a lot of their money on food. The rich spend less of their money on food. But if you look at food expenditure, it's about 16%. Housing will account for about 10%. So that's 22%. And then transport, depending on where in the income quintiles you are, you'll spend... about if you are poor, you'll spend about 15% of your income on transport. And if you are rich, they're probably about 3%.
Dr. Paddy Lehotla, the Statistician General, joining us there to speak about consumer spending. And a point that he made there is that poorer members of society spend more money on food than the rich. So the majority of their money goes to food. And this comes, as I was mentioning earlier, as Pick and Pay has announced it's offering its customers the options of purchasing groceries on credit. Now, Matthijs Potgieter is the spokesperson for DebtSafe. And Matthijs, I'm curious to hear from you. What is your view and DebtSafe's view on people buying groceries on credit? Does it just put them further into debt, or is it a viable option?
What we believe at DebtSafe is saying that when you buy food on credit, which is an essential living cost, what you basically mean is that you pay more for your food in the long run, which means that you possibly over indebted because you cannot afford your basic financials per month on basic essential living costs. You don't have the cash flow for it. Credit is not a bad thing. Credit can be a good thing. It depends on how you manage your credit. So as soon as we go into credit on living costs like food and we don't pay it off within the 55 weeks or days, sorry, that ShopRite or Checkers is given, Pick and Pay is giving it for free, that means that you're going to pay more after 55 days for those bread and milk that you actually purchased in the previous month.
So how should consumers be approaching this new offering from stores to buy food on credit? I mean, is it a viable option for them, or is this the last resort?
I believe that this is the last resort. It is definitely a viable option if you manage it properly and you say that this is your budget, and we say that around about 800 to 1,000 rand per person per head or per head in a household is the average budget for groceries per month. If you pay that into that store card and you manage it like that as a cash product, then that would work. But as soon as you go into credit, you're going to start paying interest. So that bread and milk is going to cost you more in a month's time than what you actually had to pay for it.
Mateus Porchita, spokesperson for DebtSafe. Thank you for your time. Fascinating statistics coming out from StatsSA there, that beer accounts for 2.1% of total household spending, and poorer South Africans spend most of their money on food, and that food can now be bought on credit from some shopping centres.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Midday Report.
18 minutes to 1 o'clock. I'm Mandy Wiener, in for Stephen Curtis on the Midday Report today. And the ANC in the city of Johannesburg has gone to the High Court to force council to hear a motion of no confidence aimed at unseating Mayor Herman Mashaba and Speaker Vasco da Gama. The DA-led coalition has previously rejected a request to conduct the vote in secret, saying that it is in conflict with the council's standing rules. So that hearing has just started in the High Court in Johannesburg. Eyewitness News reporter Mia Lindeke is there for us, and she's on the line now. Mia, what exactly does the ANC want the court to order in this case?
Mandy, we've just heard the beginning of the arguments placed by the ANC's lawyer advocate, William McCarty. He is arguing, firstly, that this is an urgent matter. He says that that specific council meeting is taking place tomorrow. And what they want to do is they want the court to rule that a decision by the Speaker of Council, Vasco da Gama, to refuse the application for a motion of no confidence against him and the mayor not to take place tomorrow. They want it to be declared unconstitutional and unlawful.
Seems we've just lost the line from Mia Lindeke there. We'll get back to her a little bit later. But as she was saying, what essentially is happening here is the ANC is going to court to try and force a vote of no confidence to take place in the Mayor Herman Mashaba and the Speaker as well. We're trying to get Mia back on the line. We'll come back to her a little bit later in the show if we can.
SMS us on 31702 or 31567.
Now in Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel has been re-elected for a fourth term, making history. But there's also been a historic surge from the far-right nationalists. Merkel's conservative Christian Democrats saw its worst result in almost 70 years. But it will remain the largest party in parliament there. The nationalist AfD won its first seat and is set to be the third party in parliament. And there were some protests in Berlin and Frankfurt and Cologne on Sunday night. And the AfD is seen as anti-Islam, anti-refugee, and they've even been labelled Nazis by some protesters. Tiso Blackstar associate editor Ranjani Munsami is obviously no stranger to all things politics, as you well know. She's been in Germany watching the elections there. I spoke to her a little bit earlier on today, and I started off by asking her whether or not Merkel stays in power is a hollow victory or not.
It's not really a hollow victory. I think that most Germans were looking for stability from Merkel, and you know, in a time of international chaos, and commotion by the Trump administration, tensions rising with North Korea, I think that they were looking to keep Merkel in power. But it was quite evident from this election that there is a level of discontent. Generally, with the way of the world, but particularly with Merkel's decision on the refugees in 2015. Although there hasn't been a direct impact on the German way of life, so for example, there hasn't been an increase in unemployment, it hasn't really had an impact on the economy, there are people who have been rattled by this influx of refugees, and they feel that it's an attack on them, and therefore they wanted to teach Merkel and the establishment a lesson. So a large portion of this AfD vote, this hard right party, a large portion of that vote is basically people saying, we're discontented, you can stay in power, but know that we are not happy.
Well, we have seen a surge of far-right nationalists across Europe, from Le Pen in France to Brexit in the UK. What does all of this mean for Germany and the way forward now for Merkel?
Well, the big fear is that Germany's politics might swing right in order to be able to accommodate this right-wing party, and to make sure that it doesn't have any more resonance in the population, that Merkel's administration will have to accommodate this constituency. But I think that most people are also of the opinion that Merkel kind of has a steady hand in the way she conducts herself and the way she steers the ship here in Germany, so that she wouldn't veer too much off course, that she will keep her eye on the issues impacting on Europe, so such as trade relations, such as security and climate change. Those are important issues for the European community, but also that she will try and steady things when it comes to domestic politics. However, that as you mentioned, that there will be a new coalition government under her. The formulation of that new government is not yet known. It can take up to 4 months to actually establish that government. So it'll be a while yet before she's good to go and ready to kind of steer Germany on a new course. But this is also likely to be her last term. So I think she will look to be proving herself and establish a firm legacy.
Ranjini, you were actually outside the AfD's celebration party last night in Berlin. So there were some protests outside. Paint the picture for us. What did you see, and what was the sentiment on the ground there?
Well, it was actually Sunday night, as soon as polls closed, and it became clear that the AfD won 12.6% of the vote. Now, Mandy, for you and I, that's not really much. If you look in terms of our own politics, 12.6% is negligible. But the fact that with Germany's history and the experience of the Nazis in Germany, there's this fear that grew, particularly amongst the youth, that there could be this massive swing to the right and a kind of change in the way of life in Germany. And that is why you saw a lot of radical youth out the party of the AfD. They're having a celebration party. People were there. They were chanting, but there was a heavy security presence. They were kept at bay. But the type of chants that you heard was "Nazis out," and that kind of slogans where people say are extremely angered at the racism that this party openly projects. It went on for a few hours, but by yesterday morning, things kind of calmed down, and I think reality is starting to set in that these people will not have a major voice in politics, but they will be part of the mainstream now. They will have a platform to project their right-wing views. And I think for those youth that were demonstrating on Sunday night, that is a scary prospect.
Just to bring it home, you have written a piece asking whether Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma could be South Africa's Merkel. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the experience of Angela Merkel and Hillary Clinton in the U.S. shows that, there's no free pass for women leaders. There's no romanticism in the world about having a woman leader. There is that kind of sense in our country, Mandy, that it's time for a woman leader. That's certainly the kind of platform that Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma is campaigning on, that it's time for a change and it's time for a woman leader. But both with Merkel and Clinton, they had a rough ride these last two elections. With Merkel, she does not style herself as a kind of mother figure, as a person who is there to just project women's issues. Whereas Clinton made a concerted effort to campaign hard on issues such as equal pay and childcare. But you know, it shows that the general population doesn't really have an appetite for those kinds of issues. They, I think people by and large care about their way of life, about what's better for them generally, the entire population. And this romanticism about a woman leader is just not cutting it. So I think that Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma and her campaigners need to be aware of that, that even in our country, you need to give more. And we're not seeing it on the NDZ campaign. We're not seeing what the issues are that she really stands for. Mm-hmm. And I think that should be worrying for her.
TISO Black Star Associate Editor Ranjani Munsamani, who's in Germany watching the election results unfold there. Thank you for your time on the Midday Report.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
6 minutes to 1 o'clock. I'm Mandy Wiener in for Stephen Curtis on the Midday Report today. And in the United States, President Donald Trump has unleashed, unsurprisingly, a fresh volley of tweets ramping up his feud with NFL players who protested over the weekend. Across America, football players took a knee, they locked arms or stayed in the locker room in protest against Trump's comments and amid racial inequality. And this is in a week when there's a crucial Senate healthcare vote, there's a North Korean nuclear threat, post-Hurricane Maria suffering to deal with, and he's taking on the NFL. Brooks Spector, Associate Editor of the Daily Maverick and U.S. foreign policy expert. Sure, where do you even start with Donald Trump? What have you been watching, I imagine, over the weekend, what's been going on football fields across America, and what's your view on it?
Hi, Mandy. As a matter of fact, yes. I mean, you can't avoid it, really. I mean, it's in all the newspapers in the U.S. It's on U.S. radio stations. It's on U.S. television. It pervades and fills up the whole universe, which I guess is something that Donald Trump seems to like. He wants to be the bride at every wedding and the baby at every christening. And he doesn't tolerate dissent or disagreement very much. Mm-hmm. And he loves ramping up the Twitter feud with Kim Jong-un in North Korea, something extraordinary, in addition to all the other things that you were inventorying. The feud with the National Football League is quite something. If you remember, it started last year with Colin Kaepernick, who went down on 1D in protest against police shootings of a number of young black men. And now it has, as you noted correctly, expanded to virtually every team in the league. And Donald Trump has taken the extraordinary moment to criticize the owners, the players, and anybody who supports it as if this is a direct affront to him and every other loyal and patriotic person in the country. And there are cynics who say he's had a feud with the NFL for years because he used to be part owner of a team in a rival smaller league, the U.S. Football League, that no longer exists, and the NFL would not take that team into its league. So maybe that's part of the origin of his annoyance with the NFL. But he's doing that, just as you say, the moment the Senate is now about to vote on round number something or other in the repeal and replace effort by Republicans on the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and it now seems almost certain to fail because at least three Republican senators have announced publicly they will not support it. They need at least a majority, or at the minimum, 50 votes. They're not now apparently going to get that. And in the meantime, the foreign minister of North Korea has announced that some of Donald Trump's more intemperate tweets and the flights by American strategic aircraft in international waters close to North Korea constituted effectively a declaration of war. Now, I don't think anybody declares war by tweet, but...
unless you're Donald Trump, of course.
Well, I mean, he hasn't. The North Koreans have decided that whatever it is he is saying constitutes that. But regardless, the ramping up of this of two 10-year-olds is really quite extraordinary.
Brooks, just to bring you back to the football briefly,
sure.
You know, Donald Trump has said that this is not about race. You know, he says it's about the flag, it's about the anthem, but it's so obviously about race. Do you think this is a manufactured controversy by Trump using race to pander to his political base?
Well, it's certainly using the question of taking the knee to pander to his base, it's certainly partly about race. It's certainly partly about how he defines patriotism. And it's also, at least in part, about how he defines the nature of protest and dissent. He doesn't like either of them. And as a result, you have the unseemly specter of the Trump administration engaging on a verbal war within and a verbal war without, even as the nation's business goes on or doesn't, depending on whether you're Donald Trump or not. It's just quite extraordinary to watch all this. In my house, we've declared Saturday a Trump-free zone. We don't watch or talk about him very much on Saturday.
Trump Shabbos.
Absolutely.
And you know, obviously, his tweets about North Korea, as you mentioned, really escalating. I mean, he called Kim Jong-un a little rocket man last week, and now they're seeing it as a declaration of war. You know, between now and this show tomorrow, no World War III happening, no nuclear onslaught?
I don't think so, Mandy. I suspect that if you called me tomorrow, I would be able to say, oh, dodged another one. remember the North Korean leader called Donald Trump a dotard, and it took a lot of people by surprise. We all had to look it up and see what it meant. It meant an old fool who can't pay attention to his surroundings, and it's not a kind phrase, let's put it that way. But I'm just absolutely astounded by the way Twitter has become the preferred means of diplomatic communication. That wasn't how I was trained when I was a diplomat all those years ago.
Brooke Spector, different generations. Now people declare war on Twitter. 1 o'clock. Thank you for joining me for the past hour. I've absolutely enjoyed it.